Hello, lords and ladies. Welcome back to Of Swords and Magic. My name is LJ, and I apologize for the lengthy delay in the creation of the next episode. Unfortunately, I am not able to make episodes as often as I'd like. However, as I said in the first one, I will certainly make episodes as often as I can. So, welcome back to the second episode! Yay! If you're just now joining us, my name is LJ, and this is a podcast about Arthurian legend. I try to discuss everything from the literature to adaptations of the literature to characters to portrayal throughout the centuries. Anything you could possibly wish for, whether you're a beginner or whether you're a pro. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. We're going to have a bit quicker of an episode today, since the first one was introducing characters and introducing the legend and introducing myself. So, now that you guys already know who everybody is, now we can just jump right into it. So, today we are going to discuss religion in Arthurian legend. Don't worry, I will not force any sort of religion upon you. I'm just going to state facts and state some theories, and we'll go from there, okay? We're discussing religion because religion is one of the most major components of Arthurian legend. It's basically the foundation on which most of the plot lines and twists and turns and major conflicts in all Arthurian legend are based. So we're going to go into detail about that today. For starters, the two major religions in Arthurian legend are Christianity and paganism. So, Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table, well, most of the Knights of the Round Table, of course, depending on the adaptation, sometimes this excludes Gawain and Lancelot, but Arthur, Guinevere, and the Knights of the Round Table all fall under the Christian category. They're all typically Christians. The pagans are going to be the ones with magic, so Merlin, Morgana or Morgaine, Morgause, and Mordred. Pretty unfortunate, actually, that all of the pagans in Arthurian legend happen to all be villains. I wonder, actually, if that's the reason why paganism has earned itself the negative connotations that come with it when we hear the word now, because of all the villains in Arthurian legend that happen to be pagans. Something to think about. Okay, so the way religion is typically incorporated into the legend is as follows, which we sort of discussed in episode 1, but not to great detail. So, the storyline usually goes that Arthur, of course, is a Christian king. His father Uther before him was Christian, and his father before him was Christian, and so it goes. The royal line of Camelot has always been strictly Christian, and the kingdom has been a Christian kingdom, a Christian land. Magic and paganism are forbidden, because it's considered the old religion. So Uther always forbade magic and paganism, and so Arthur, when he became king, did the same, following in his father's footsteps. Which is really funny, because Arthur was born of magic, and Uther knows that very well, obviously. And yet magic and paganism are not allowed in Camelot. Anyway, Arthur is expected to keep Camelot Christian. However, his half-sister, Morgan, or Morgana, let's just call her Morgana, okay? Morgana has magic and is born with a magical gift, which is considered paganism. And Merlin, his advisor and trusted friend, also very clearly has magic. So, the story usually goes that Arthur, when he comes of age and becomes king, allows paganism back into Camelot. Yay! And so Christians and pagans live together in harmony. It's a wonderful unity of religion and of people and culture. And it's wonderful, and that's why everybody loves Arthur, because he is compassionate and accepting and understanding and open to learning different ways of life. However, here comes the twist in the story, which you guys know if you have heard the first episode. Morgana, of course, turns evil, for lack of better terminology. She realizes that she should be heir to the throne, because technically she has the rightful place. She was not born of magic, she was born on magic. what's the right terminology for that? She was born regularly. Which is so funny because Arthur was the one who was born of magic, so why isn't he the one born with magic? Why is Morgana, who was born a natural birth, why does she have magic? I don't know. Anyway, since magic was forbidden at the time that Arthur was born, and he was born of magic, technically, he was born illegitimately, making him an illegitimate king, at least in Morgana's eyes. So she turns evil and decides to get her revenge on Arthur by trying various times, many, many ways, to kill him so that she can assume the throne. And of course she uses her magic against him and against everybody else. So that therefore makes magic and paganism frowned upon in Camelot. It can't be forbidden because Arthur has already claimed it to be allowed within the kingdom. However, paganism has now become feared once again and has now developed a negative connotation. And so people have become very leery around magic-born people in Camelot. This lasts all the way up until Mordred kills Arthur and the legend ends. So luckily, Morgana doesn't turn on Arthur until later in the story, in the legend. So there's quite a few years in which Camelot lives in peace, having both religions and cultures living together under one king, under one crown, living peacefully. So thank heavens for that. There are, of course, several stories in which paganism and Christianity are used together in Arthurian legend. For example, all of the stories in which Merlin teaches Arthur how to be a good king using his magic. And of course, there are thousands of stories of Merlin using his magic for other various reasons. But that, what I just explained, is the main way religion is incorporated into Arthurian legend through plotline. Okay? So what we're going to talk about now is how religion is incorporated into the legend through iconography and through symbolism, which is a major, major topic. So let's start that, shall we? Let's start with the two most famous pieces of Arthurian symbolism or iconography that there are. Can you guess what they are? That's right, it's Excalibur, and I'm sure everybody knows the answer to this one, the Holy Grail. Ba ba ba. So let's start with Excalibur and talk a little bit about that and its relation to religion. So as we said before, Arthur was a Christian king, so his sword, Excalibur, can often be seen as a Christian symbol. If you look at Excalibur, or if you look at any sword, and you'll see that if you hold it by the hilt, so the handle where you put your hand, and the blade is facing downward, it sort of looks like a cross, doesn't it? There's a little cross guard that goes across the handle or the hilt or whatever, and it looks like a cross. So it was said that when Arthur was holding Excalibur, it almost looked like Arthur was holding a cross while he fought. Now, a sword, of course, is a weapon used for fighting, so this symbol, this Christian symbol, can be seen as a symbol of fighting for Christian morals, or fighting for just good morals in general. Arthur spent his reign fighting for peace, for justice, for equality, for mercy, all the things that Jesus Christ was said to have fought for, right? So it's kind of a cool comparison. And this comparison often painted Arthur as a sort of Christ-like figure, which he sort of was in a way. And of course, not saying that Arthur was Jesus Christ, it's just a similarity. For example, let's look at Jesus Christ. He sacrificed himself on the cross for his people, right? So the cross was Christ's burden to bear. Excalibur was, in a way, Arthur's burden to bear. Arthur didn't want to fight. He didn't want to fight his son. He didn't want to fight his sister. And yet he had to for the safety of Camelot, for the safety of his land and for his people. So in a way, Excalibur was sort of Arthur's cross. Jesus sacrificed himself for people's sins. Arthur basically sacrificed himself for his family's sins. Jesus Christ was also, during his time, the most popular person in the land, and of course the most popular person in the world, and of course still is today. Arthur, during his time, was also the most popular person in the land, and in the realm of Britain, for that matter, and is still talked about today. We study him in literature classes. Additionally, Camelot was the most popular, the most flourishing, the most powerful kingdom in all of Britain, therefore, of course, making King Arthur the most popular and flourishing and powerful king in all of Britain, and in many regions besides. And of course, with power, with that kind of power, comes jealousy and fear, just as it did with Jesus. Jesus had several people who were jealous of him and who feared him. No one really feared Arthur, though they were certainly jealous of him, as we can certainly say for Morgana and Morgause and Mordred. So there's that similarity as well. Another comparison is that of Jesus and his disciples. What does that sound like? Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table! They both followed their leaders in more ways than one. They loved and believed in their leaders and everything that they stood for. Arthur even had a Last Supper, actually. Of course, he didn't pass around the bread and wine and claim that the bread was his bone and the wine was his blood, but nonetheless, he had a Last Supper with his knights on the eve before the last battle in Camlann. Isn't that funny? Ow. Klutz. Also, in a group like that, there always ends up being a Judas, doesn't there? So, Arthur's Judas was, of course, Morgana, or Mordred. In some adaptations, Mordred actually ends up being part of the Knights of the Round Table, so he would definitely be considered a Judas. But in most cases, it's Morgana who turns around and stabs Arthur in the back through Mordred. Another similarity is seeking wisdom from a higher place. Jesus sought wisdom while he was on earth from God, right? He sought assistance from God for dealing with temptation, for dealing with the pain and hatred and fear that people inflicted upon him. Arthur also sought wisdom from God while he reigned, and also sought wisdom from Merlin, who can also be considered a sort of a godlike figure in many ways, and we'll get into that a little later. As we said before, both leaders fought for equality, for justice, for fairness, peace, mercy, and they succeeded. But my favorite comparison is resurrection. Christ was resurrected, right? He came back on Easter, and is said to still return again. Arthur is called the once and future king, and is said to return when Albion's need is greatest. So, that gives one a lot of hope, doesn't it? I think that's one of the most magical aspects of the legend, is that one line, that Arthur will return again, and Albion's need is greatest. Albion meaning the land of Britain. I don't know why they called it Albion. I'll look it up and get back to you guys. Anyway, overall, both figures were considered figures of hope for the people. So that's the main way that Arthur can be considered a Christ-like figure. Let's get back to symbolism. So all of that was from the point that Excalibur is a Christian symbol. Another Christian symbol of Arthurian legend is the Holy Grail. We're gonna get into this for quite a bit. So let's delve into the fact that the Holy Grail starts from a very Christian standpoint. The Holy Grail is said to have been the grail that Christ drank from during the Last Supper. That's why it's holy. It's a pure, righteous symbol, and in some adaptations, and in many other stories that aren't even Arthurian, in which the Holy Grail is involved, the grail can often be considered a magical symbol, or even a magical object. Some people can drink from the grail and they're cured of disease, or they're cured of something else, a wound or something. So, the Grail is a highly Christian symbol, but it can also be a highly pagan symbol because of its magical uses and magical properties. So let's look into that a little bit. The Holy Grail, throughout almost all the legend, is considered an object or a symbol that King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table strive to achieve, strive to find, strive to withhold throughout several adaptations of Arthurian literature. The Christian side of the Grail is, of course, the fact that it's said that Christ drank from it, but also the fact that it's a symbol, the Grail is a symbol that Camelot is the purest, most righteous, most rightwise kingdom to rule all England, all of Britain. So withholding that object, having that symbol in possession, physically in possession, would give Camelot the greatest reputation for all time. It's almost like a confirmation from God that Camelot is the greatest kingdom in all the world. And so that's why the Knights of the Round Table spend years and years and years striving to find it. So the characters who go after the Grail, typically, are Arthur, Lancelot, Galahad, and Percival, or Percival, all of whom are Arthurian legend's purest knights, or purest characters. Arthur wanted the Grail in the heart of Camelot because of all the reasons we mentioned before, but also because Arthur thought, he felt that it was a reminder of what it meant to be a good king. He thought it was a symbol to help him remember to improve his conduct as a ruler. Not that he wasn't already a great ruler, but he wanted it in his castle as a reminder for him, something to look up to, something to aspire to. Galahad and Percival wanted the Grail for the same reasons, but also as a reminder of morality, that morality is essential in any good kingdom, and a reminder of the values that they hold dear, and that they wished other Knights of the Round Table, fellow Knights of the Round Table, to hold close to their hearts as well. And all of them, Lancelot especially sometimes, wanted the Grail because it was a symbol that we should always believe in something higher than ourselves. Especially Percival, and we'll get into his story in a minute, because actually Percival probably has the most religious story in all Arthurian legend, so we'll get to that in a second. But those few things are essentially what the Grail meant to the Arthurian court, and that's why it held the religious significance that it did. So while we're on the subject of the Holy Grail, we're going to dive into Percival a little bit for a second. Percival usually is the one to go after the Holy Grail in most adaptations because he's considered the purest of all the knights. His story usually starts off in his forest while he's still living with his mother in the cottage in their forest, before he ever went to Arthur to become a knight. And his mother gives him all of this advice about going to church every Sunday, and why it's essential that you should go to church every Sunday, no matter what, and always remember God and keep God in your heart. And so he goes on his quest to become a knight, and he goes on this whole adventure, which we're not going to talk about, we can save that for another episode, which I will promise that I will go into elaborate detail. But he goes on his journey, and throughout the course of time ends up forgetting God, because he gets too caught up in revenge for a particular event that happens, and he loses sight of what's important. He forgets to believe in something higher than himself. He forgets God. He forgets all things that are pure and good and innocent and merciful, which is essentially what makes him so pure, his mercy. And he forgets everything that his mother told him to remember, and therefore has a more difficult time finding the Grail. So in Cretien, his name is Cretien, or Cretien, in Cretien's work, Cretien is one of the earliest authors of Arthurian literature. In Cretien's story of the Grail, Percival forgets God, forgets all that is good in the world, and therefore doesn't end up finding the Holy Grail, and that's where the story ends. So that's his religious outlook, Cretien's religious outlook, I believe, which therefore became a major message in Arthurian legend. So, in other adaptations, when Percival does remember God and remember to be merciful, he does end up finding the Holy Grail, and usually it comes to him through God himself. Sometimes he dreams it, and God comes to him in a dream and gives him the Grail in the dream, and the Grail is not even really an object, but it's a concept, a thought of what it means to be pure of heart, what it means to be righteous, what it means to be good in every aspect, good in every way that a human possibly can be, and what it means to rule a kingdom in the most righteous and right-wise way possible. And then Percival wakes up and goes to King Arthur and explains his dream, therefore delivering the Holy Grail to the Kingdom of Camelot. In other adaptations, it is an actual object, and he brings the object to Camelot, and Arthur does end up having the Holy Grail in his castle. So either way, no matter the adaptation, no matter what happens in the adaptation, Percival usually ends up being the one to deliver the Grail to Camelot, if the Grail ends up coming to Camelot at all. In some adaptations, they never find the Holy Grail, which is true for a lot of humans. A lot of us don't end up finding what it means to be the purest we can possibly be, and the best, absolute best person, the bigger person that we can possibly be. But that's how life is, that's how people are. However, for those who do find it, hopefully they'll share that knowledge with the rest of us, and we can learn from it, just like Arthur wanted to do with the Holy Grail, and spreading its significance and spreading what it meant and what it stood for to the rest of Camelot and throughout the rest of Britain. So, getting back to iconography and symbolism, let's talk a little bit about Gawain, because Gawain has a shield that is also holds religious significance, and a lot of his story does too. So let's talk about him for a little bit. Sir Gawain, at least in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Sir Gawain has a shield that represents his stance on Christianity, because he is a Christian knight. So he's got this red shield, and it's got a gold 5-pointed star on it, and the star usually represents his dedication to Christ. In Gawain and the Green Knight, it says it's a symbol that Solomon designed long ago as an emblem of fidelity, and justly so. Therefore it suits this knight and his shining arms, for always faithful in 5 ways, and 5 times in each case, Gawain was reputed as virtuous. So I'm reading this article about that right now that says, these 5 ways in which Gawain is virtuous are in the dexterity of his 5 fingers, the perfection of his 5 senses, his devotion to the 5 wounds of Christ, his reflection on the 5 joys of Mary in Christ, and finally, 5 virtues, generosity, fellowship, chastity, courtesy, and charity. The pentangle is an appropriate representation of these 5 areas of virtue because each of the 5 sides of the pentangle transitions seamlessly into the next. This aspect of its geometry might represent the way in which the virtues are interrelated, each area feeding into and supporting the other. And these are all, these 5 virtues are all what Jesus Christ preached about, right? What he wanted us to practice. Also, on the inside of the shield, it says that he had a portrait painted on the inside of his shield of the Virgin Mary. So he was very religious. So Gawain was carrying this Christian shield around everywhere he went as a reminder for himself. Then came New Year's Eve, or Christmas Eve, depending on the adaptation. A holiday feast in which the Green Knight, the mystical Green Knight, came riding in, ruining their party, which we'll go into detail about this entire story another episode. But the Green Knight comes barreling in. You guys probably know what he does. He throws down his head, or throws down his gauntlet, rather, and declares a challenge on King Arthur, and Gawain is the only person who stands up and says, "I'll accept your challenge." And then he fights the Green Knight, blah, 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 blah. We're gonna skip all that. The Green Knight clearly is pagan, because he's a mystical being, right? He chops off his head, Gawain chops off his head with his axe. And then the Green Knight reaches down. The headless Green Knight reaches down, picks up his own head, which was rolling on the floor a couple of seconds ago, and places it back on his shoulders. And he's like, well, you thought you killed me. Just kidding. You're gonna now have to find me a year from now, and I will chop your head off, because that's the promise you just swore to me before you tried to kill me. So, anyway, we'll get into the story another time. But the point is, the Green Knight was pagan. Now, when Gawain goes out in search of the Green Knight a year later, and goes on his whole adventure, blah blah blah, he finally comes to where the Green Knight is said to live, which is the Green Chapel. And of course he stays in Bertilac's house and all that. Again, we'll get into it later. But this is sort of an interesting, at least to me, it can almost be a sort of message from the pagans to be respectful of the pagans, even though he's Christian. What I mean is, Gawain, being as prideful as he is, he was a proud young knight, right, in this story. And not only is he proud of his Christianity, but he's proud of himself and his deeds, and he already had the reputation of a good, sturdy, very dependable, strapping young knight. So of course he accepts this challenge, and then his reputation grows even higher. So now he's got this pride, and of course his journey of course brings him down a couple notches. However, he's still prideful, and especially about his Christianity, as well he should be. He's a very religious man, and he looks up to something higher than himself, especially in hard times, like on this quest. So when he comes into the Green Chapel, comes into this sort of den where the Green Chapel probably is, it's almost like the pagans are angry with him. There's these pagan spirits that can be felt all around, and it describes it very mysteriously. This is a translation by Simon Armitage, who is my favorite. He's absolutely wonderful. We'll talk about him later when we talk about Gawain in depth. Anyway, it says, he stalls and halts, holds the horse still, glances side to side to glimpse the Green Chapel, but sees no such thing, which he thinks is strange, except at mid-distance what might be a mound, a sort of bald knoll on the bank of a brook, where fell water surged with a frenzied force, bursting with bubbles as if it had boiled. He heels the horse, heads for that mound, grounds himself gracefully, and tethers Gringalet, looping the reins to the limb of a lime. Then he strides forward and circles the feature, baffled as to what that bizarre hill could be. It had a hole at one end and at either side, and its walls, matted with weeds and moss, enclosed a cavity, like a kind of old cave or crevice in the crag. It was all too unclear to declare. Green church? Chunters the knight. More like the devil's lair, where, at the nub of night, he makes his morning prayer. For certain, he says, this is a soulless spot, a ghostly cathedral overgrown with grass, the kind of kirk where that camouflaged man might deal in devilment of all and all things dark. My five senses inform me that Satan himself has tricked me in this tryst, intending to destroy me. This is a haunted house, may it go to hell. I never came across a church so cursed. With head helmeted and lance in hand, he scrambled to the skylight of that strange abyss. Then he heard on the hillside, from behind a hard rock and beyond the brook, a blood-chilling noise. What? It cannoned through the cliffs as if they might crack, like the scream of a sky being ground on a stone. What? It whined and wailed like a water wheel. What? It rasped and rang, raw on the ear. My God, cried Gawain, that grinding is a greeting. My arrival is honored with the honing of an axe up there. Then let the Lord decide. Oh well, won't help me here. I might well lose my life, but freak sounds hold no fear. So Gawain is hearing all these noises. The water is bubbling like it's being boiled. The wind starts howling. There's this giant noise that sounds like it's being scraped against stone, and like a water wheel is turning, and it fills the entire cave. It's a little creepy. So it could be considered that perhaps these are the pagan spirits that are fellow spirits of the Green Knight, welcoming, quote-unquote, welcoming Gawain into their territory, with quite a bit of a warning because of Gawain's pride, because of how easily he chopped off the head of their master or whatnot, simply because he was this unnatural, quote-unquote unnatural being, which is simply part of the pagan tradition, a spirit. So they knew how Gawain had treated their master, and they wanted to make sure he knew whose territory he was now in. He was no longer in Christian territory, he was in theirs. So this can be considered, on our subject of religion, a way in which paganism takes the lead for the dominant religion in the Arthurian literature, just for this story in particular. Launching off of paganism as a dominant religion, for those of you who have heard of Mists of Avalon, I would say Mists of Avalon would definitely be another piece of Arthurian literature that can be put in that category. For those who don't know of Mists of Avalon, it's a book written by Marion Zimmer Bradley, in which Morgana is the lead, or the main character, and the whole story of the legend is told from Morgana's point of view, or in Marion Zimmer Bradley's case, Morgain, as she's called. Morgain is part of the Sisterhood of the Goddess, which is basically a druidic religion. It's certainly a pagan religion, and it's essentially druidism, in which nature and all things in nature is worshipped, and instead of a god, it's the goddess, and she's basically Mother Earth. So basically they're worshipping Mother Earth, or the goddess as they call her, and the tradition of incorporating the story in which Arthur unites both Christianity and paganism under one crown in Camelot definitely happens in this story, but the characters go through great lengths, or at least one character in particular, goes through great lengths to ensure that the sisterhood, that druidism, that paganism and magic is the dominant religion over Christianity, even though Arthur claims both religions to be equal and wants them both to be equal. There are some people who want it to be a little more dominant. And in this case, it's not Morgain or Morgana. In this case, it's actually the Lady of the Lake, Vivienne, who can be considered a villain in some cases and can also be considered a heroine in some cases. Depends on how you look at it. It's part of the beauty of the story, a part of the beauty of her writing, Marion's writing. Merlin is also a part of the story, although he doesn't try in such a terrible way to restore paganism. However, speaking of Merlin, since we are on the subject of religion, Merlin, the BBC show, I don't know if any of you've heard of it, there is a BBC show called Merlin about young Merlin and Arthur, and about how Merlin helps train Arthur for what it means to be king while in the position of being his servant. It's a very cute, quirky show, and actually ends up being very tragic at the end. It starts off so cute and corny and a little cheesy, and then by the end of the series it's super dark and dramatic and incredibly epic. You should definitely go watch it if you haven't already. It's on Netflix. It's delightful. Anyway, in that case, since we are talking about all Arthurian legend, not just the literature, in the TV show, Merlin is required to keep his magic secret, since magic is still forbidden in Camelot, and it takes Arthur a very long time to even consider uniting Camelot, or uniting both religions under Camelot. However, young Merlin does try his best to convince Arthur that paganism can be used for good and not just for evil, and that not all pagans, not all druids are evil, and that they're people just like Christians, and that both cultures, both people, both religions can in fact live peacefully under one crown. without letting him know that he has magic. So it's a very intriguing show. You should check it out. But anyway, that's another example of how religion is incorporated into the legend through young Merlin trying to convince Arthur to do so, to unite both religions. Okay, so those are the main ways that I can think of that Arthurian legend incorporates both major religions, Christianity and paganism. There are, as I know, several adaptations of the legend in all different formats, all different varieties, books, movies, TV shows, etc., poems. So if you know of any and would like to share with everyone how religion is incorporated into the legend, please do so and message me on my Facebook page of Swords and Magic. Go ahead and like it if you haven't already, and send me a message. Let me know of something I missed, and then I'll definitely include it in the next episode. While we're on that subject, please let me know if there's anything else that I can incorporate into our episodes. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, anything you'd like to speak your mind about, please hit me up. Give me a message on my Facebook page, and I'll definitely get back to you. Anyway, that concludes our episode for today, so thanks so much for joining me, you guys. Again, if you have any questions or comments, please let me know on my Facebook page. Go ahead and give it a like. And if you would be so kind as to give me a follow on ofswordsandmagic.podomatic.com, I'd greatly appreciate it. And I hope to see you next time. Fare thee well, lords and ladies, and thanks again for listening to Of Swords and Magic.